Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, beloved community radio station. I'm your host for today, Fran Michelle. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from Karl Marx's figure for the revolutionary forces that are working away, unseen, underground, undermining the terrain of capitalism from below. Today is April 20th, 2020, and the Old Mole, like the rest of KBOO's programming, is currently being produced from a little further underground than usual. Special thanks today to John Nilsson, Denise Morris, Tom Becker, and Patricia Kohlberg for help with editing, posting, and music, and thanks, as always, to the KBOO staff and all the KBOO members and volunteers who make the show and the station possible. If you can donate a little bit or a little bit more online to maintain this essential service, please do so by clicking on the Donate button in the upper right corner of the KBOO.org webpages. Today's show features discussion of coronavirus capitalism and the persisting problems of the climate, and as always, includes discussions not only of the crises we face, but also the ways that folks are resisting, persisting, envisioning, and organizing for a better world. You've probably heard the stories of workers in healthcare, at Amazon, and in other workplaces being fired for raising concerns about their health and safety in the COVID-19 pandemic. By last week, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration had received over 3,000 worker complaints about employer culpability for workers' unnecessary exposure to the virus. Bill Resnick talks with one worker and organizer, Travis Watkins. Formerly with General Motors, he was fired after raising concerns about worker safety. Then Bill talks with Alexander Bradbury of Labor Notes about organizing during the pandemic. Next, we'll hear from Joe Clement, talking with philosophy professor Jason Reed, about the neoliberal dangers and progressive possibilities of life in and after the lockdown, including questions of pedagogy, screen time, and universal basic income. Finally, we hear from Jan Hocken talking with Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center about defending the activists trying to save us from the slightly slower but even more threatening crisis of the climate. Along the way, we hear music from Bradbury and from John Prine, who recently succumbed to the coronavirus. Prine was the troubadour of the trials and tribulations of common folks, of their heartaches and crises, and the hope of overcoming. As always, you can find the Old Mole online at kboo.org/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can hear any segments you missed, share them with your friends, subscribe to the show, and send us questions and comments. We also invite you to like us on Facebook and Twitter. We turn now to Bill Resnick's conversation with Travis Watkins and Alexander Bradbury, including a musical interlude featuring some of Bradbury's revisions of popular songs.
Travis Watkins, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Travis Watkins was, and hopefully will be again, a mechanic at a General Motors plant in Wyoming, Michigan. Travis was recently fired for warning his fellow workers that two other workers were suspected of having the coronavirus and had been removed from the factory on a stretcher. Travis will tell the story, then we'll get into discussing the views of workers about working during the epidemic and about the UAW, that's the United Auto Workers Union, and about the group that Travis founded. It's called Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD. Very clever, Travis. Tell us about why you were fired, how it happened.
Okay, well, so on March 16th, I received a few phone calls from inside the plant. Some workers were telling me that a couple of members had been driven out on a medical cart by security wearing face masks and that they were being removed from the plant for suspected COVID-19 symptoms. I reached out to my local leadership, part of the executive board for my local, and in my efforts to try to organize and to protect these workers, I reached out to them for that purpose, and I did not hear back from our local leadership. And the very next morning that I came into work, I was told by a supervisor that I was immediately being put on suspension pending an investigation. And when I inquired to what the suspension was in regards to, he said he didn't know. I had him call labor management at our company, and they weren't able to provide me with any information. So the following day, I was told that at 10 o'clock we were going to have a meeting, and at that meeting, I met with plant management, and had an international representative with me at that meeting, and I was told I was being terminated. And my reason for termination, they quoted a shop rule violation 2, which was assaulting, fighting, threatening, coercing, or interfering with employees or management. And they provided a Facebook post that I had made inside of a private Facebook group that deals with on-job site conditions and union member concerns. All the post said was it had been reported to me some people had been walked out of GM with suspected COVID-19 symptoms, and that I had reported it to local leadership. And that was the reason that they used to terminate me.
Your discussions with both the union leadership and the company, to the extent you could talk to them, you were asking that they would disinfect the factory, and you were asking for a lot more safety equipment, especially for the workers who were cleaning up the place.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's correct. So what happened is, on March 16th, I noticed a General Motors salaried worker passing out bottles of cleaner to my bargaining unit as well as to the GMCH bargaining unit. And I stopped him because he was with one of my workers, and I asked him what was going on and what they were doing. And he said, well, we're beginning some cleanup workstation areas to disinfect for COVID-19. And I noticed there was no personal protection equipment, that these employees hadn't been trained properly on the proper ways to mitigate and clean up for COVID-19. And I said, you know, unless you guys can provide the proper protocol as listed by, you know, CDC or OSHA, you know, with face masks and the gloves and some requiring, you know, Tyvek suits and whatnot to do this cleanup, that, you know, we weren't going to do it, and it was a health and safety issue, and he needed to address that. Obviously, I was met with frustration and anger from him because he had to stop what he was doing and see what he could do about that. But again, the following morning, I was terminated.
You've been really active in the union, co-founding Unite All Workers for Democracy, and I read the article in Labor Notes about the firing. You were thinking of running for the president of the local union. My understanding is that the Facebook page must have been provided to the management from somebody else in the union. Do you think there is some kind of collusion between union leadership, who doesn't do, who are very, who want to stay in office, and any challenge to their position gets met with hostility? And that happens in a lot of workplaces. The union leadership doesn't want to be challenged, and they collude with management.
In fact, that absolutely did happen in my case. It was reported to me and verified from another very good source through my investigation that part of the local management, in fact, did take my post and my messaging to the executive board and took that to management and colluded with them to initiate my termination. That's, in fact, it is a fact.
Yeah. Travis, one issue I wanted you to talk about, you know the people in the plant, you were elected to the e-board of the union. How do workers feel about being forced to work during the pandemic? It seems to me there's people have to earn an income and pay the rent or pay the mortgage and buy food. Most people have a family. So they, on the one hand, they want to keep working. On the other hand, they don't want to bring COVID. They don't want to die or get really sick, or especially bring it back to their families. What do workers think about what you're doing, which is challenging the company? There are some who are really afraid of challenging the company, right, because the company always has this sword above their heads. We'll move to Mexico or Brazil, or we'll switch all the work to some other plant in the United States unless you knuckle down, unless you give in, actually, and keep quiet and do your job. very fast. How does that all work out? What's your sense of the working class people now facing this tremendous pressure just to keep a decent job?
People are fearful of, you know, obviously coming into exposure of this. As you may know, the companies and the international union had another joint task force with this health and safety issue. It's a lot of people's belief that this another jointism or jointness with the companies has left members at risk. Instead of addressing international coming and addressing issues on a local level to provide information, education, and support health and safety in the plants, they again partnered with the company in this joint task force, and it was delayed in shutting down these plants. The response is now is coming to an agreement to when these plants will reopen. And again, not using any local leadership at the local level to address the issue. It seems to me and many other members that they're kind of putting the company, mitigating the company's profit loss in this issue with the COVID-19 versus the health and safety of their members. So people are afraid. They don't want to lose their job. They're afraid to speak out for the reasons that I find myself in now. But as a local leader, that's my responsibility to stand up for the membership and to make sure that they're safe on the job. That's just what we're trained to do. That's what we're supposed to do. And it's the right thing to do.
Travis, I read about you on Labor Notes. The article was very informative, but also at the end, you're trying to keep your family alive. You have a GoFundMe donation opportunity there.
Right. I started a GoFundMe page because myself and my family are obviously with this attack from the company on my livelihood. I'm now without employment. I filed for unemployment, but the company is fighting me on that so that there's an appeal process there to even get my unemployment, and that could take weeks or months. Also, I have high prescription costs for my family. They have some of my children have medical needs, and I'm without insurance. So that's the reason why I started the GoFundMe page, is to kind of get caught up on some bills and some of the prescription costs that I have for my family. And I've had some great contributions, and people have been very generous, and I very much appreciate it, and my family appreciates it very much.
Travis Watkins, keep up the good work. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Bill. I really appreciate the time and the interest that you've taken in giving me the opportunity to speak out on this health and safety issue to keep the membership safe. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
If you tell me how much misery working people will put up with, I'll tell you how much misery we're going to get stuck with. That's the words of Frederick Douglass, and he hasn't been wrong yet. Said we don't get all we pay for, but we pay for all we get, because power concedes nothing. Power concedes nothing. Power concedes nothing without a demand. Never has, never will.
Hi, Alexandra Bradbury. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, Bill. It's great to be here and have a chance to send solidarity and good wishes to all those great folks in Portland, where I lived for many years.
Alexandra Bradbury is the same Al Bradbury who worked for SEIU Local 49 in Portland. She was also one of the hosts of Labor Radio on this radio station. She went from Local 49 and KABU to become an apprentice journalist at the monthly magazine Labor Notes. Now she has become a co-editor of Labor Notes. Today we're going to discuss the coronavirus, how unionized workers and also workers who have no union are responding, including response by every level of service work, especially the lowest paid. They have a slogan, from invisible to essential. And they could continue, I guess, from the minimum wage to maybe even a living wage, maybe even get some respect. So Al, I just interviewed Travis Watkins, who I learned about through the Labor Notes website. For you, Travis's story is just one of many that Labor Notes carries, stories of worker struggles that the establishment press, even local papers, doesn't cover. Or if they do, it's from the employer's point of view. Labor Notes is really different. Tell us about Labor Notes.
Labor Notes has been around for 40 years and has always existed to create a forum for rank-and-file workers, rank-and-file union members as well as non-union workers, to connect with one another, to learn from one another, and as you say, to tell their stories, which often go untold. We've published a monthly magazine now for more than 40 years, which often carries stories written by workers describing how we organized the strike, how we won this demand, how we're fighting this issue in our workplace, written for other workers to read and learn from and teach one another. We also organize conferences. We do a big international conference every 2 years, so we had to postpone it this year due to the pandemic. And we organize local events, troublemaker schools, secrets of a successful organizer trainings. Portland has been host to many of these events where local union and non-union workplace activists teach each other, learn from one another, nuts and bolts strategy to build a more militant and fighting and winning labor movement. And lately, during the pandemic, we've been doing tons of organizing, trying to provide support to people who are fighting to make their jobs safer, to, in some cases, shut their workplace down for safety or win the rights and protections they need. We've been doing lots of webinars and conference calls and publishing, you know, four times as many articles as usual because there's so much going on, so much workplace activity to support and spread around so other people can follow one another's lead.
Right. Al, tell us about some of the other struggles. Travis Watkins was one of many, 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 including many others in the UAW, United Auto Workers Union.
Yes, the auto workers are one of many sectors where one of the immediate things workers did was organize to demand to close down non-essential work. Auto plants and many other kinds of plants and workplaces, the employers were slow to close down, you know, wanted to squeeze as much profit out as they could, and as workers discovered that their coworkers or supervisors were getting sick, you know, experienced the reality of not being able to socially distance at work, not having the protective gear they need, auto workers, you know, had walkouts and demanded to shut their plants down, which they did, although the auto companies are certainly making rumblings about wanting to reopen those as soon as possible. So that happened in many sectors and is still happening. There are also less organized, large-scale sick-outs. People may have seen lots of meat and poultry plant workers are not going into work in large numbers and sometimes effectively closing down plants. And then there's workers who are considered essential and are being asked to continue to work, who are organizing to demand the protective gear they need, extra compensation for the risks that they're taking, to rearrange their work or make changes to make it safer and better. So one that I found really heartening early in the crisis was a wildcat strike by bus drivers in Detroit, who they didn't wait for the employer to decide. They shut down the buses and said, before we go back to work, we have some demands about how the buses need to operate differently to be safer during this crisis. And they won all of their demands. And one of them was no collection of bus fares for the duration of the crisis, which certainly makes drivers safer during the pandemic because they don't have such close contact with people. It's also the collection of the fare, the enforcement of the fare, is one of the sites of conflict and violence that puts drivers at risk of workplace violence every day. And in the recession moment, it's also a great boon to the public. So that kind of change where workers got together and said, we see how we could improve the situation at our work and demanded it and won it, that spirit is something I hope we can keep even after the crisis is over.
Al Bradbury of Labor Notes. One more issue that really is quite inspiring in some ways. All those service workers now rallying under the banner from invisible to essential. It's a great slogan. All those delivery truck drivers and home care workers and cleaners and grocery workers and health workers, many at the lowest level, cooks and restaurant workers, they're now being seen as essential, which we always knew and tried to argue. This is sort of an incredible wake-up call in some ways, and it fuels demands for respect and a decent wage.
Absolutely. I think there's both the sense of the public awareness of the importance of so many workers who are often overlooked and the workers' own awareness of the power that they have, that society really can't continue without them. In terms of the public awareness, of course, it's long overdue to celebrate sanitation workers, transit workers, postal and delivery workers, grocery and warehouse workers, healthcare workers, you know, who are often, their voices are ignored and suppressed and their concerns are pushed down by management. But this is a moment of tremendous opportunity for workers to build connections with the public because all of us are seeing every day the risks workers are taking, their centrality to our lives. The CEOs all work from home or take time off. It doesn't really have any impact. on you and me, but all of these regular and, as you say, often underpaid workers are tremendously important. And so I think it's a great time to make the point about why we need to support and pay well and sustain our public services, why, for instance, we shouldn't privatize the post office as corporate interests want to do, or allow them to contract out to the lowest bidder things like transit and sanitation. But it's also a moment when workers can realize and seize upon the leverage that they have, because a company like Amazon has been forced to admit that, as high-tech as they are, all of their work depends on human labor. And so you've seen these protests and walkouts at Amazon. Amazon was forced to give a $2 an hour raise during this period. Amazon has also retaliated. Like, they see that workers are getting a sense of their power, and they want to try to suppress that. They've fired several workers, both tech and warehouse workers. But the crisis moment really shows that there are all of these choke points where workers' labor is essential to producing the profits and to keeping the public going. And it shows why workers have the power to organize. And I think that is part of why we're seeing this real ferment, both in union workplaces where rank and filers are getting organized and making demands without necessarily waiting for their union leaders even to take the lead, and non-union workers too. And it's a great time for unions to make connections with non-union workers and organize them. And I think one more thing that's been inspiring to me to see is workers who are taking this moment to think bigger about what kinds of changes could be made in their work in the public interest. In particular, these General Electric workers who held pickets around the country to demand that their plants, where usually they make jet engines, be converted to making ventilators. And you have auto workers in Oshawa for GM, whose plant is in the process of being closed down, who have been saying for a year now, well, we should convert our plant to green vehicle production, and are now saying, well, let's also use it to make masks and medical equipment that's immediately needed. In a moment of crisis, business interests will seize on it and try to use it as a chance to accelerate their agenda. But I think it's also a chance for workers to say, when things come to a halt, let's take the opportunity to come up with our agenda and say, let's reopen on our terms and take this as a moment to pivot towards the needs of workers and the needs of the community and reimagine how our jobs could be when we come back to them.
Al Bradbury, really good talking to you. You're an essential worker from my point of view. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thanks so much, Bill.
That was Alexandra Bradbury singing I'll Organize, because that's what we'll need to do to survive. And before that, Bradbury and Travis Watkins talking with Bill Resnick about workers doing just that. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, your host for this 4/20/20 episode. We turn now to Joe Clement talking with philosopher Jason Reed about trends, hopes, and fears about neoliberalism in the time of the coronavirus.
Good morning. This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today, I'm joined on the phone by Jason Reed. Jason Reed is a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine. He's a pretty prolific blogger on his website, Unemployed Negativity. We'll include a link to that. His research and writing covers many topics, but he's a Marxist. He is a scholar of Spinoza and materialism. He writes a lot about film and television and popular culture. He writes a lot about social and political philosophy around questions of subjectivity and of the politics of work. He introduced me years ago through his blog to Kathy Week's book, The Problem with Work, which I reviewed on The Old Mole a few years back. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole today, Jason Reed.
Sure, thank you.
I wanted to bring Jason on today to specifically talk about neoliberalism and the corona crisis, and I think that makes a good starting point. What do we mean when we refer to neoliberalism influencing society and this current crisis?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an important question. I think part of the appeal of the way that neoliberalism gets used is it gets used to talk about something more than an economic system, but begins to encompass like an entire political and cultural system. Anything which, is predicated on the individual and individuals in competition. I guess one of the things that I keep thinking about is how these current measures of social distancing are strange. I mean, there's a strange kind of paradox in the sense that in the name of solidarity, we kind of give up the physical presence in interacting with others and retreat into our own private spaces, and how in some ways I feel like there's a real risk that preference of the private and the home over public engagement is only going to further entrench tendencies towards isolation and competition. And one way to think about this is you look at the way in which this current pandemic and social distancing is affecting people in very different ways depending on what kind of private resources you have. I mean, I walk around with my dog during this time. You know, I walk by your playground, which has been closed down in the name of public health, and walk around some houses where people have elaborate private playgrounds in their backyard and their children are able to play outside. They walk by, you know, apartment complexes where kids don't have the same opportunity. So there is a sense in which there's a kind of culture of neoliberalism, a kind of sense of I've got mine for you that I feel like is further entrenched by this. I mean, I've done some mutual aid work and so on, and it is very strange. I think the strangest thing is people who are trying to fight that and trying to engage collectively is that so much of what we do collectively and so much what builds things like solidarity are being able to be in the same place with people and interact with them and doing the same thing over Zoom or phone or internet. It doesn't create the same sense of trust and engagement that you can create when you get a bunch of people in the same place. Social distancing is a strange kind of solidarity, and one I wonder, like, when we come out the end of this, what's going to be entirely transformed, and are people going to be more and more inclined to stay out of public transportation, to stay out of public places, and, you know, more and more inclined to stay in their own homes, use automobiles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which seemed to me to be a social disaster. I mean, not saying it's the same as people dying, but it would be a destruction of something that's already very weakened in our culture and society.
Yeah, and you're already in the midst of one of these big institutional shifts with higher education and even the K-12s or the high schools attempting to switch to some kind of replacement, although they will be wishy-washy about how much of a replacement it's really intended to be, but it is filling a gap educationally and time in terms of how people structure their children's days with this online supplement. And online education already exists. There's a controversy in Portland, Oregon, where Concordia University decided to close this last year, and it had switched to an online university to try and facilitate this closure. And so what are the risks of, you know, how we are affecting our ability to even kind of communicate and educate ourselves out of this mess, depending on how deep it gets?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, yeah, my university, like many, we switched to a kind of forced online conversion, and my university already offers many classes online. And there's always been a strange thing about online. You know, the lingo you get from a lot of administrators is that students want online education, but I don't think that's entirely accurate. It's more often the case that online education is the only thing that fits with people who are pushed by multiple jobs, parenting responsibilities, and so on, where, you know, once you undermine an ability for someone to really engage with education, then online becomes the only thing that is sort of left to them. And, of course, this is pushing even more people towards online. Now, a whole set of different issues with that. I mean, is it the same education they're getting? I mean, I know in some instances, especially around, like, schools where people are getting, you know, education in arts or performance, students are pretty much claiming they want a refund. They don't want this kind of version that can be delivered online. And then there are also concerns about how much power we're giving to some of these private companies that are delivering the online education, how much they entail their own techniques of surveillance and so on. I mean, my hope really in the midst of all this is And I feel the same way about this in terms of what I said earlier about the public. My hope is that maybe at the end of this, people will come to value what they're now forcefully denied, that people will begin to think, okay, now I understand what happens in a classroom is not reducible to the transmission of information or knowledge. It's its own space with its own kind of relations, and that what happens in a classroom can't really be captured in a video transmission, that has a lot more to do with how people relate to each other and how people have discussions and so forth, and to see things like classrooms as transformative spaces. But that's the optimist in me who imagines that maybe, you know, we'll come out of this thing, as we do begin to come out, kind of tired of mediated forms of communication, tired of screens. I know I'm getting tired of screens and tired of those sort of interactions, and with a real thirst for being physically present to each other and being able to interact that way. The optimist in me wants to believe that we'll come out of this maybe wanting to ditch our screens.
That leads me to want to ask about the pessimistic responses that are proliferating, especially around the extension of emergency powers, which have very serious consequences for how the government as we know it can all of a sudden open up to very autocratic rule.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about that is that, you know, right now, and this, of course, varies from state to state and from country to country, you know, there's some version of a kind of lockdown, quarantine measures, you know, keeping people at home, closing some businesses and other sorts of things. To me, it seems to me the real big anxiety, especially in this country we're hearing now, is this idea that the president and other people in power want to reverse that, want to get people going back to work. And my real question is, you know, Can they do that by decree? What is it going to be like when suddenly, especially if this happens too soon, before people feel like there's been any measure in terms of testing or other things to keep people safe, if tomorrow or someday, not too far from tomorrow, if suddenly the federal government or state government would decide, hey, you know, you're open for business, you have to go back to work, how will people actually respond? I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is that unlike other countries, especially in Europe, where governments are actually paying people's employers to continue to pay them, by and large, in the U.S., what we have is a lot of people don't have a job anymore. So they can't even be told to go back to work because they don't have an employer. And people talk about, I think there are real concerns that maybe some of the strategies that will come out in the mid period, and by that I'm referring to everything that happens between now and when a vaccine is developed, and the strategies of, say, for example, testing and surveillance, you know, where somehow we all have to register our test status and be monitored. These might be real increases of powers of surveillance, but at the same time, I feel like the thing the state very much wants to do right now, which is reopen, as they put it, get people back to work, is a thing which it might find out that is in some sense powerless to do. Although, my real concern is what this is going to do with so many people out of work and so many people with very little resources, savings to rely on, that people may find themselves going back to their jobs or similar jobs with less pay, and if they had a union and collective bargaining agreements, with those dismantled as well. But the real thing that state may be trying to do is use this entire pandemic to further exacerbate the power difference between workers and capital, where people at the end of this are so desperate for work that they're willing to accept working conditions that they wouldn't have accepted before. That, to me, is the scariest prospect, almost more than the idea of the state having more power of surveillance and so on.
There are a lot of people who are pointing to the European countries that you mentioned and others, saying that this is a perfect opportunity to roll out a universal basic income. You've written quite a bit about that. I mentioned Kathy Weeks in my introduction. And What do you think of the possibilities of this are, the desirability of it, and how that would or wouldn't interface with the longer-term project of overthrowing capitalism?
I mean, I feel like it's been pretty clear, I mean, given the paltry payment that the U.S. government has agreed upon, that it's pretty clear that the biggest fear, and this has been articulated by several politicians in Texas, especially in Florida, where they've pretty much said, we're afraid that payments to be so great that people don't come back to work, right? That's always been the fear, that universal basic income will make it so people don't want to come back to work. So I think that in this country, at least, if there is any kind of universal basic income, it's going to be very paltry and very much organized around the idea of generating enough demand to keep businesses functioning, but not doing anything to jeopardize wage labor and wage labor at some of the most poorly paid positions, especially. But at the same time, I mean, this is why I feel like, you know, we're very much living through a moment where it's hard to say what this is going to entail, because we're in the midst of this moment. We can't see it. And at the same time, I mean, people, the two things that really sustain our economy, both economically in terms of where dollars come from and go, but also ideologically, are our work and consumption, in the sense that both people have to work and then people find a lot of their, or encouraged to find a lot of their entertainment, enjoyment, and consumption. And both of those have been radically interrupted. People aren't working, and people are, of course, still buying stuff in markets, but they're not consuming. I mean, some people are buying a lot of mail order or whatever, but people are not consuming in that same kind of sense of enjoyment. These two things have been interrupted, and people are suddenly finding themselves making a new life in this moment that's not organized around work and consumption. And to me, that's always been the more interesting thing about universal basic income. And that's, in some sense, that's already kind of happening. And to me, the big question is, when people have had a taste for a life not organized around work and consumption, how is that going to change how they think about work and consumption when these things start to come back? I mean, are people who have found themselves being able to spend time with family, time on things that they enjoy, are those people going to suddenly look at the demands of the working week and say, you know what, I've decided I don't want this anymore, or it's not as important to me? And there's one possibility. Of course, the other possibility is people will, you know, desperately clamber to get work back, to get consumption back. I mean, I think we're going to see a combination of both, but I think the real question is, you know, how people make sense of what's happening right now and how it transforms their way of understanding what supposedly counts as normal in this country. It's hard to say because we're in this moment. You can't really see what's right in front of your face. But to me, it does seem like in the interruption, there's always a possibility. And we're living through a massive interruption right now.
That, I think, is a good note to end on.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Jason Reed of the blog Unemployed Negativity. You can follow his blog, unemployednegativity.com. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine and the author of many books and articles.
Thank you, Jason Reed, for the coming on to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Sure, thank you. Take care. Bye.
Then the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. Then they wrote it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauled it away.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and we just heard a conversation between Joe Clement and Jason Reed, followed by some of the late John Prine singing about the heartbreak of environmental destruction. Climate change has not stopped for the pandemic, and the slowing of travel and commerce has given us only about a 5% reduction in global fossil fuel emissions, less than the reduction from the 2008 economic recession. So we need to do more. In our final segment for today's show, we hear from Jan Hocken talking with attorney Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center about the trial of Extinction Rebellion activists for their actions at Zenith Energy here in Portland last year.
Welcome to KABU, Lauren Regan.
You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was John Prine again, and before that, Jan Hocken and Lauren Regan discussing climate activism and the necessity defense. You can hear an extended version of that interview online on the page for that segment at kboo.org/Old Mole Variety Hour. You can also find there links to sign up for the Civil Liberties Defense Center's weekly webinars. Another project involving some moles can show you more about the necessity defense in climate cases. This Wednesday on Earth Day, you can watch for free online an advanced version of the documentary Necessity. Again, the link to sign up for that is on the Old Mole page for that segment, as well as at the website necessitythemovie.com. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host for today's show. Thanks to Moles Bill Resnick, Joe Clement, and Jan Hocken for their interviews. And thanks to their guests, Travis Watkins, Alexander Bradbury, Jason Reed, and Lauren Regan. Thanks again to Background Moles, John Nilsson, Denise Morris, Patricia Kullberg, and Tom Becker. And thanks to all of KABU's workers, volunteers, and members. Support us by clicking on the Donate tab at kboo.org. And tune in to The Mole again next week for more homemade radio. Views, reviews, and interviews from the grassroots.
Thank you for having me. Well, you and other staff at the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene have for years defended activists in civil and criminal cases, often working with movement lawyers in other regions of the country. One of those cases went to trial here in Portland in February, less than 2 months ago, with five Extinction Rebellion activists charged with trespassing at the Zenith Energy Terminal in Northwest Portland. The action was in April 2019 and intended to disrupt operations of this local hub of fossil fuel transport that had recently expanded its capacity for transporting oil through Portland, including the highly toxic tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada. Lauren, can you tell us briefly about the charges against the Extinction Rebellion activists, a local group, and the choice of the activists to enlist the necessity defense?
Sure. The Extinction Rebellion Portland group purposefully created a campaign that was going to intentionally cause economic disruption. They put a bunch of soil on the train tracks leading into the Zenith facility. They put a little tiny house there. They planted a garden in the soil. They very intentionally knew that they were risking arrest by engaging in this act. They had built a campaign for many months and the community for years against this expansion of the Zenith terminal and Zenith as one of the largest carbon emitters in Portland and in our bioregion, really. And so when five of them ultimately did get arrested and charged with misdemeanor criminal trespass in the first degree, it was not exactly surprising. And because they had worked their campaign and they had chosen the individuals that were actually going to risk arrest and go to trial in this way, they had done all of the proper legwork that activists need to do in order to bring a viable choice of evils defense before the court.
Let's listen to a clip from the trial where you introduce the necessity defense to jurists and then have you explain more about this strategy and what you hope the jury would hear.
At the heart of this case is the choice of evil, which is ironic given the evidence and testimony that you've heard, because it certainly seems more like a necessity than a choice at this time. But as jurors, you do have a choice. At the end of this case, you can find that the defendant's actions are not criminal. You can make the determination that all of these defendants are not guilty of criminal trespass.
This is Jan Hocken talking this morning with Lauren Regan, attorney with the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene. Lauren, what were you hoping the jurors would hear?
So the larger framework is the jury, which is supposed to act as the conscience of a community, you know, they're supposed to be the moral compass, they have the final decision-making authority as to whether a defendant is going to be found guilty or not guilty. On the one hand is the imminent threat of catastrophic climate change. They can be both local and global in nature. They are serious, they are imminent, they are an existential crisis to the survival of the human race. And on the other hand is this temporary economic disruption that resulted in a trespassing charge. It's your duty to balance these scales and determine whether or not these individuals should be held criminally responsible or not for that charge of criminal trespass. In every trial, it's the judge's job to instruct the jury about the law, basically to give them the roadmap that they have to follow with regard to the law. And, you know, one of the very unique things with this case is this was the first case in the history of the United States that we know of where the climate necessity defense was allowed to go fully through the process, meaning we were allowed to put on climate experts to testify in front of the jury. We were allowed to put graphs and exhibits and evidence in front of the jury about the harms and the imminence and the effectiveness of direct action as a tactic. And then the judge actually gave them an instruction that said, you're allowed to do this balancing.
What are the elements of the defense? In addition to clarifying that, could you speak to what jurors seem to struggle with most?
Sure. So 5 out of 6 of the jurors voted not guilty in this case. One juror basically got hung up on the idea that criminal trespass is a crime. They obviously trespassed on the train tracks and on the property of Zenith, and he just was unable to do this balancing that the court was requiring. The court basically told them, use your intelligence, use your own ethics and morality, and do this balancing. The desirability and urgency of avoiding catastrophic climate change versus the desirability of avoiding criminal trespass in the first degree. The intention of these defenses and this law is based on the idea of the public interest and that sometimes you do the right thing even though you might be risking trouble from the law.
In assessing the outcome of the trial that resulted in a mistrial, what's your take on the use of this legal strategy in going forward?
Well, I think it is an incredible victory for the climate movement in that, you know, we have now had a full test case go through the process of utilizing the climate necessity defense and ultimately having an overwhelming majority of the jurors vote in our favor. Just because a law is on the books doesn't mean it is always going to be enforced in a just way.
Mm-hmm.
5 out of 6 jurors voting that moral duty in favor of saving the planet is big. You know, I mean, if you were to take this, you know, out of the courtroom context, you would almost be saying 5 out of 6 people in your community, even if they don't call themselves climate activists or environmentalists, think that fighting for a livable planet is the right thing to do. As a result of this trial, the state and Multnomah County decided not to re-prosecute. And so they dismissed the charges against the defendants, and no one got convicted for blatantly committing criminal trespass. You know, the district attorney's office has the discretion to either re-prosecute or dismiss the charges. So the fact that Multnomah County dismissed the charges and decided not to re-prosecute is a big deal. And I have to say that part of my belief on why they made that decision was because all sorts of really bad stuff came out in that courtroom about Zenith Energy.
Yeah.
And Zenith Energy was the quote-unquote victim of this crime. And I think Zenith Energy did not want to have all that bad stuff come out into a public courtroom again. They had no defense for all of the really bad stuff that they've done and are doing. And I think the corporations, the fossil fuel industry, learned a lesson that even if these people were convicted and found guilty of trespassing, they still got what they wanted and needed out of the public courtroom.
And it is quite different political climate for climate resistance, different regions of the country where communities are more or less dependent on the fossil fuel industry in their area. It seems that Zenith is itself seen as kind of trespassing on the community.
You're exactly right. You know, when we were in Minnesota and North Dakota on the valve turner trials, in North Dakota, we never were allowed to use the necessity defense. In Minnesota, we were allowed to use it, but the court ruled in our favor and acquitted all of the defendants before we even got to put on our experts. Even without putting on expert testimony, just having the defendants testify about what their intent was and why they were compelled to face arrest and, you know, and turn off these valves. After the trials were over, we had conservative rural landowners come up to us and thank us for educating them about climate change and thanking them for trying to help their communities. And so a big part of using the courtroom as part of a climate campaign is potentially trying to educate people that you might not normally be able to talk to or that you might not have normal connections to. And when you do it in a courtroom, there's this semblance of legitimacy to it.
In late March, the governors of Kentucky, South Dakota, and West Virginia all signed laws designating oil and gas pipelines and facilities critical infrastructure and imposing new penalties against people protesting this area of infrastructure. In closing, could you speak to that way in which the pandemic is heightening the stakes on both sides and where you see hope and pitfalls in the landscape ahead?
You know, when you see corporations like the fossil fuel industry passing all these critical energy infrastructure laws, it's not going to deter any activists from continuing to work on their campaigns and to continue to risk arrest, because activists that risk arrest already know that they might face criminal charges, and because the prosecutor has all the discretion in what they're actually charged with, there was always a threat, potentially, that an activist would end up with a felony. So whether it's called criminal mischief or critical energy infrastructure or felony trespassing or whatever it might be, that's not going to deter an activist from engaging in direct action and economic disruption. What I think those types of laws tell us, though, in a positive light, is that the industry is on its heels. The industry believes that the only way that they are going to maintain society being okay with them profiting off of killing the planet is by passing laws so that they can say, look, we're the good guys. We have these laws on the books that say those activist people are the bad guys. They're the criminals. If there's a law that says if you walk on a pipeline easement, you're a felon, well, then those that walk on the pipeline easement must be bad guys, and the people who are maintaining those pipeline easements must be the good guys. You know, that's what the industry is hoping will be the outcome of these kinds of laws. But I think more and more what we're seeing is people are really becoming wise to the idea that that industry has spent billions and billions and billions of dollars subverting our democracy and subverting all of the normal systems that we as Americans should be able to utilize to advocate for ourselves and to protect the public interest. And I think more and more they are being outed as the rich bully that is tipping the scales in a way that is both unfair and undemocratic. And I think that this onslaught of ALEC-sponsored fossil fuel industry gifts in the legislature may actually backfire on them. All those legislators with their hands out taking that fossil fuel money should probably go find another job. And they should be replaced by people who aren't going to take bribes and corruption and actually are going to be there to represent the people that they are elected to represent. And I believe that the overwhelming majority of those people desire clean water and a livable planet for themselves and their children.
As the airs have cleared in this pandemic, perhaps some of the clarity of those points will also be more visible. Lauren Regan, thank you so much for your work and being on the Old Mole with us today again. And your work is so important, and we want to support it in whatever way we can, as well as hopefully taking to the streets again when we are able to as well.
We are doing a weekly webinar for activists right now while everyone's in quarantine. Every Thursday at 3 p.m., we're doing an online webinar on a different topic. The next 3 weeks is a three-part Know Your Rights training for climate activists, and then the 2 weeks after that is Know Your Rights for youth climate defenders. People can go to our website to register for those and to find out the details if they're interested.
Thank you so much, Lauren Regan.
And thank you for having me.
I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses.
You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was John Prine again, and before that, Jan Hocken and Lauren Regan discussing climate activism and the necessity defense. You can hear an extended version of that interview online on the page for that segment at kboo.org/Old Mole Variety Hour. You can also find there links to sign up for the Civil Liberties Defense Center's weekly webinars. Another project involving some moles can show you more about the necessity defense in climate cases. This Wednesday on Earth Day, you can watch for free online an advanced version of the documentary Necessity. Again, the link to sign up for that is on the Old Mole page for that segment, as well as at the website necessitythemovie.com. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host for today's show. Thanks to Moles Bill Resnick, Joe Clement, and Jan Hocken for their interviews. And thanks to their guests, Travis Watkins, Alexander Bradbury, Jason Reed, and Lauren Regan. Thanks again to Background Moles John Nilsson, Denise Morris, Patricia Kullberg, and Tom Becker. And thanks to all of KBOO's workers, volunteers, and members. Support us by clicking on the Donate tab at kboo.org. And tune in to The Mole again next week for more homemade radio, views, reviews, and interviews from the grassroots.